Betty Bowers and Sister Mary Sue House are two young physicians in training in the Duluth Family Practice Program. They reflect on some of the situations they can expect to encounter in medical practice in a rural setting.
If you have a problem and you need some help and you look around, well, there's probably two people that, at least, you know, in a small town situation that you can go to. There's your, you know, clergyman, or there's your doctor. They don't have extensive counseling services, and they certainly didn't way back. And if you're really stuck and you need help, you need some outside consultation, and somebody who's not necessarily personally involved, then you would have to come to one of these two people. And I think that's probably where a lot of it came from. And then when you do have a lot of people's personal problems on your shoulders, then I think it that too makes it somewhat of a barrier to getting to get more personally involved with them on a, you know, social level.
I guess my concern as I think about it is, again, thinking about the other person, you know, that I'm going to be coming in contact with and that I'll be seeing in the hospital or will be coming to the office. And I think just being a woman, for one thing, is going to make some people uncomfortable because the traditional role is a masculine one. I think males, for example, are not readily at all going to be inclined to come to a woman physician. And that, again, is why I see another disadvantage for solo practice for myself. And it wouldn't be able to be a partnership with other women. It would necessarily, I think, for the comfort of the people that we're trying to care for, have to be some kind of male partnership in some way. I guess we've been warned by some of the women doctors here in town who have spoken to us that probably after the age of 12, we won't necessarily see any male patients until maybe around the age of 60. I think until women are more, I don't want to say accepted, but seen as professionals in this area, and people can be comfortable with either a masculine or a feminine physician, that, you know, it's the people that'll just have to try and get used to it, and ourselves. We'll have to not take things personally either when people do not choose to come to us for one reason or other, because women in medicine are still not that common, and particularly in family practice.
The small town doctors that I know from when I lived in a small town, you know, go to the Rotary Club.
Yeah.
You know, they do all those things.
And I'm going to cross that bridge when we come to it.
And that's going to be interesting, because a doctor in a small community has a very definite social position.
I guess that's one of the things that I'm really impressed with my classmates. Sometimes impressed, and sometimes I think it's maybe accentuated a little bit, but I think if there's a main theme in this group of people that I'm going to school with, the theme would be one that there's a strong emphasis of breaking out of that social role. Why should friends of doctors necessarily have to be exclusively lawyers, other professional physicians, or just other professionals of some sort? Why can't they be just a cross-cut of all the people in town? Just we're people, you're people. You know, make friends that way instead of on a professional basis or a working career basis. So I think that medicine in general is maybe moving out of that kind of the doctor has a social role to fill.
From the 1920 novel Main Street by Sinclair Lewis, Dr. Will Kennicott talks about the problems of his role. Do you realize what my job is? I go around 24 hours a day in mud and blizzard trying my damnedest to heal everybody, rich or poor. You that are always spieling about how scientists ought to rule the world instead of a bunch of spread-eagled politicians, can't you see that I'm all the science there is here? And I can stand the cold and the bumpy roads and the lonely rides at night. All I need is to have you here at home to welcome me. I don't expect you to be passionate, not anymore, I don't, but I do expect you to appreciate my work. I bring babies into the world and save lives and make cranky husbands quit being mean to their wives. And then you go and moon over a Swede tailor because he can talk about how to put ruchings on a skirt. Hell of a thing for a man to fuss over.
Anybody who is, gets to know me from here on out will be acquainted with the fact of what I'm thinking of doing. And I'm sure that, cuts a lot of people out of the competition, because I'm competition. But, when you have your plans laid out, and although I haven't got, extensive plans, my future is somewhat definite right now. And anybody who gets to know me after this will necessarily have to include that in whatever they're thinking. And I think that that way a relationship would develop where we would not have that many problems. It would be somebody who would want to do the same things that I do.
I think the girls, excluding myself, have been talking about the problems of possibly getting married to someone who was not earning the kind of salary that they were earning, and would this be hurtful to their relationship, and what kind of problems could result from that. And I think these are all very practical things that, again, need to be crossed when the situation arises, and you really can't pre-plan any kind of an approach, I don't think.
No, you can't. Pre-planning doesn't do a thing, because those plans are just, so much fantasy up in the air. But the whole thing about people's maturity and things, and especially now, most of the people I know, most of the males that I've come in contact with in school, here, and in college, don't have a traditional outlook on life. I'm going to be the man of the house, and I want a little wife that's home in the kitchen. That type of thing is more prevalent now than, say, 30 years ago, I'm sure, although I wasn't here 30 years ago. I just have a feeling that it is. And the fact that many people have marriages where both spouses are working, that work out fine. The people are happy, they're doing what they like to do, and neither one of them has to feel like he's being put on. And I think that that's the type of relationship it will have to be. And I think it's very possible. It's happening to lots of people.
And another sequence from Main Street, in which Carol decides to show an interest in her husband's medical practice. Don't I, in looking for things to do, show that I'm not attentive enough to Will? Am I impressed enough by his work? Oh, I will be. I will be. If I can't be one of this town, if I must be an outcast. When Kennicott came home, she bustled. Dear, you must tell me a lot more about your cases. I want to know. I want to understand. Sure, you bet. And he went down to fix the furnace. At supper, she asked, for instance, what did you do today? Do today? How do you mean? Medically, I want to understand. Today, there wasn't much of anything. A couple of chumps with belly aches and a sprained wrist. And a fool woman that thinks she wants to kill herself because her husband doesn't like her. And, just routine work. But the unhappy woman doesn't sound routine. Just a case of nerves. You can't do much with these marriage mix-ups. But, dear, please, will you tell me about the very next case you do think is interesting? Sure, you bet. Tell you about anything that... Say, that's pretty good salmon. Get it at Howland's? Gopher Prairie, Minnesota, according to Lewis, had a population of 3,000, including the family of Dr. Will Kennicott. Sauk Center, Minnesota, the model for Gopher Prairie, still has a population numbering about the same. And for the last year, it has included the family of Dr. Michael Bess, who has been working with a local family physician, Dr. John Grant, through the university's Rural Physicians Associate Program. Driving up Highway 10 from the cities and across the new leg of I-94 that stretches west from Albany, Dr. Best looked out over the same prairie land. Immense, vigorous, harsh, unsoftened, that Carol Kennicott saw some 50 years earlier. But he didn't view it through her eyes.
And I decided not to read it while I was here either. I had a very great temptation to buy it and read it while I was here, but then I thought, well, I don't know, if I do that, then I might formulate some opinion that, subconsciously at least, that I shouldn't. So I may read it when I get back, and I have no idea what's in that book. I've heard that at the time it was published, it wasn't very popular here, but now Sinclair Lewis is quite popular here, and there's a great deal of effort being made by this community to preserve Sauk Center and his boyhood home.
Though he may not have come to the town knowing what it was like, Michael Best knows Sauk Center pretty well by now. And the same might be said of family practice. His association with Dr. Grant has taught him a lot.
I think Dr. Grant has been in practice in this town now for 30 years. And there are so many things that he has learned about dealing with people and dealing with diseases and injuries that could never, I don't think, ever be written in a textbook. And yet, here you've got firsthand access on a one-to-one basis. And it's, I kind of admire, you know, the fact that a guy like this is willing and able to help you with these things and to share, really, some of these things are just real pearls when it comes to dealing with certain conditions and with certain people, say, in the community. You know, he's seen Mrs. So-and-so or Mr. So-and-so off and on for the last 30 years and knows that this particular complaint, although it's not typical, is referable to a certain problem. And, of course, unfortunately, when you've just come out of training, if a complaint doesn't fit the typical textbook pattern, you kind of come unglued sometimes because that's not what the book says, you know. And he'll be willing to say, you know, I don't care what the book says, it's really this way. And you go on, you know, and you progress it and you follow along, and darn right, too, it's really not that way. And you can do more for this particular patient if you follow his experience. And it's all the physicians here, too, not just Dr. Grant, although he is the preceptor. But they've their generosity is really... It's amazing. They're generous with their time and generous with the knowledge, which you might say they've come on the hard way, because you know darn well they didn't learn it in medical school, because you didn't learn it in medical school. And of course it works its way down. You know, Dr. Du Bois Sr. was here before, and he, I'm sure, imparted certain things to these people when they were starting out, and now there's some things that just must be passed on. You know, when you first go into medicine, especially it's especially popular now, and I think especially true, that you say you're not going to be a deity, you're not going to be an image, you're going to be a real human being and relate to your patients on that level. And yet there are certain patients who do not care to relate on that level and who will not relate on that level. And if you don't modify your thinking to take into view and into consideration the patient's feelings, you may have difficulty dealing with that patient. And the way medicine is set up, it's a free market, end quotes. A patient can go anywhere they want, and if you attempt to deal with a patient on a very human level and they don't particularly care to be dealt with on that level, you're going to lose possibly the continuing care of that patient. And some of the most important things that can be done have to do with continuing care. It's acute medicine is very exciting and it's very rewarding, but sometimes the only way you ever get anywhere is on a chronic basis, and to see the patient repetitively, and sometimes you never make a diagnosis until you see the patient maybe 3 or 4 or 5 times and get to the root of things. You'll see just almost anything. I'm continually amazed at the things that walk, or the things that come into the office in the course of an afternoon. Now, obviously, I'm talking about the patients that come into the office, but the way things present and the way people present and the diseases that they present in the office. Many of the things are rechecks of, say, a follow-up, a 3-month follow-up of a high blood pressure or something like that, or an OB check, something like that. We see our OBs once a month. But many of the things that are just absolutely fascinating from my point of view, from a scientific point of view, and extremely interesting from the human point of view. Sometimes I'll get enveloped and engrossed in talking to a patient and spend maybe 45 minutes with one patient, and this just puts you behind, and then the next time you go out and look at your charts waiting for you, you could just fall over. But at the same time, it's time that I think is very worthwhile. You've spent maybe 45 minutes with a patient finding out things about that patient and having him relate things to you that I don't think would have come out any other way. And just sit there and keep digging into the things that are deeper than what they superficially appear. As I mentioned before, it's not uncommon at all to have people come in and with some very minor thing, and then after you look at that and reassure them that it's really nothing to worry about, the phrase comes out, the real reason I came here was to ask you about. And then, you know, some very serious conversations go on, and some very difficult times for some of these patients, because it's obviously something that they're having trouble talking about. And if you keep your schedule right on that 10 or 15 minute basis, well, you're obviously not going to have time. You've spent 10 minutes looking at the minor thing. You can't spend 5 minutes on what it is that's really bothering them. A lot of times you can help people simply by offering them the chair that's next to your desk and say, you know, this is the place you can come to, let's say it's not a medical problem but falls more into the realm of a family problem or something like that, because this is something you'll spend a lot of time with often. Making it known to them that this is always available to them, and almost always on the various levels of communication, you'll at first see a patient sitting in a chair, very rigid, with their hand usually toward their face, and their legs crossed, and in various posturings which are very tense. And as you talk to this patient and draw things out, things that have been bothering them, you'll just watch the posturing. And sometimes I draw this to the patient's attention. I'll say, now, notice the way you're sitting now and think about the way it was when you came in. And they always kind of get a chuckle out of that. But a lot of times the main help you can give is to reassure or just to listen and try and help them figure out what's going on in their life. You know, because sometimes the most vexing problems can be rooted in the fact that one cannot sort out what is going on in one's own life. And we all have these problems, you know. We have to sort out our own problems every once in a while.
If Michael Bess hasn't found the same Salk Center Sinclair Lewis knew and wrote about, it could be that the town has changed in 50 years. But more likely, the answer lies in the man and his experiences, both personal and educational.
After living in the city now for 5 years, the things that, the little things really show up big. When we first came here, remember the first night we slept here, neither one of us could get to sleep because it was so quiet. And we lived near the freeway back in the cities, and had the rush of the freeway traffic and everything. And you come to appreciate the seasons and the just the scenery and everything. It is really great. The people, the generosity of the people in a small town is almost beyond belief, and I'm sure that my position has had something to do with it, but even going back to my boyhood experiences in a similar type of town in Illinois, I can see, you know, that people are quite generous, and they're lacking many of the suspicions that people in the cities have, and it's almost unbelievable how good people have been to us and our family here. And that has really made us quite fond of living in a smaller community, as well as other things. But the people, anywhere you go, I think the people that you deal with are eventually turn out to be the most important things. And I'm not putting down people in the city at all, but I think that in the hustle and bustle, sometimes you do lose consideration for the next person. You don't know him, you've got nothing to lose or gain. Here, you may not know the person either, but there seems to be more of a rapport and a generosity between people.
Excerpts from Lewis at Zenith, a three-novel omnibus published by Harcourt, Brace & World, New York. Music from the album The Red Pony by Aaron Copland, a Columbia Odyssey recording. A Sense of Place was written and produced by Claudia Daly for Minnesota Educational Radio under a grant from the Minnesota Humanities Commission. Engineering by Glenn Owen.
The two towns, as you're well aware, might as well be on opposite sides of the moon as far as any communication between them. The St. Louis River is a fairly shallow stream that has to be regularly dredged out in order to let ships in, but it might as well be as deep as the Grand Canyon if, as far as psychology goes. Wisconsin and Minnesota's are miles apart.
In many instances, it is like living in communities that are maybe 50 miles apart rather than just separated by a river.
It's strange how significant that river becomes in terms of dividing loyalties and making it difficult for one part of what constitutes a total community to work together with the other part. Here we are constituting a natural region which has the unfortunate aspect about it that it is divided in half by a river. And that river constitutes the border between two states.
A Sense of Place, a documentary series which looks at regions and regionalism in the state of Minnesota. Produced by Minnesota Educational Radio under a grant from the Minnesota Humanities Commission. This program is called Just One Studded Tire. A river flowing between two towns is often more than a sometimes peaceful, sometimes rushing waterway. It is a boundary, a border, a line of definition and demarcation, a point of separation between my interests and yours. This is especially true when the towns are located in different states. And, useful as such boundaries were in early determination of jurisdiction and responsibility, residents of today's border communities find them troublesome. Father F.X. Shea, president of Scholastica College, Duluth, offers an historical perspective.
If you really want to define what the modern world is, the modernity of the modern world is precisely questioning whether conceptual limits are real. Conceptual limits of whatever kind are simply agreed upon, more or less agreed upon definitions. The more widely they're agreed upon, the more reified they become, the harder they are to break down. But modernity is a process of saying definition, boundary setting of in any area of life is can only be judged useful or non-useful. It cannot be judged true or false. I don't think any of us fully appreciate what an enormous revolution that is. It's probably about 200 years old, but we still haven't absorbed it. If the philosopher that did the final questioning, the questioning that nobody's been able to answer since, was Kant, and he's late 18th century. But at the same time that Kant was walking the streets of Königsberg and thinking about the illegitimacy, if you want, of intellectually established boundaries, we had the French Revolution erupting, the American Revolution, the breakdown of all the tradition that political arrangements were somehow or other eternal.
The idea of the temporary nature of political arrangements, halfway across the world or in one's own community, is now part of the general consciousness. But it has taken a long time for the philosopher's questioning to be translated into the practical questioning of ordinary citizens who've just begun to wonder why two communities with common interests must remain divided. Claudia and Michael Waukee live in Superior, Wisconsin, just across the river from Duluth. She is a nurse working in a Duluth hospital. He is employed by Douglas County on the Wisconsin side.
When you're dealing with something like a charter which controls the very existence of a city, the lines are automatically drawn, whether you like them or not. They are there. And yes, it would be nice to think in terms of regional concept, but I'm sure that's many years away.
Oh, it would make things so much easier as far as living in this area. We identify with Duluth. Duluth's problems are our problems. Madison's problems have nothing to do with our area. We share the same lake, the same highway connections, and it's just when someone asks, where are you from, it's an automatic response to say Duluth, because it is the center of this area. Superior is like a suburb of Duluth in most respects, and it just seems totally inaccurate to be connected with Wisconsin government instead of with whatever situation Duluth is in. And there's no interaction between the two cities either. You can identify with their problems, which are the same as yours, very much, but nowhere do they work together to try to solve those problems.
The transit thing is a good example, I think, because it's an example of an attempt that isn't really working.
Oh, yeah, the bus situation is just horrible and looks like it's getting even worse now that Superior is talking about getting their own transit system, which will really chop it in half. And up till now, too, the 18-year-old drinking has been a real problem as far as people looking almost with disdain upon Wisconsin for what they've permitted to happen in their state.
A Sense of Place is continued on side two of this cassette.
For what they've permitted to happen in their state. And you have to listen to a lot of this too. You have to be accountable for what your state government does when you're really interacting with most people from Minnesota.
It seems that there are more likenesses between the two cities than differences. It just seems that there should be one.
I call it bailiwickism. And there seems to be an awful lot of that, especially between Duluth and Superior. The mayor of Superior shoring up his political boundaries, trying to retain or enhance whatever power he has. And if he were to develop some programs with the city of Duluth, it would mean giving up some of his power to the power structure in Duluth, and vice versa. And I think we just have an anathema to doing that sort of thing. And again, it's unfortunate. But then if we can look at the other side of the coin, and it seems that people from other areas or from other states are a little less respectful of perhaps the state that they are visiting. And I just say this as someone who fishes a lot and is out in the woods in the northern Wisconsin area and see a lot of Minnesota people there. In fact, one out of every three cars that I see parked along the rivers fishing are Minnesota people. I see Minnesota people using Barker's Island as a place to launch their boat, and I see them just crammed into Patterson Park. And they don't seem to respect it as much because it doesn't happen to be their particular state. And when I say respect, I suppose I'm thinking in terms of garbage and littering and this sort of thing. Perhaps if there were a regional concept, they would feel differently. But as it stands right now, I often find myself getting very angry with these, we refer to them as out-of-staters, taking advantage of all the good things and not being respectful about it. I think that's rather unfortunate.
Wisconsin has been much more aggressive in developing natural resource playground areas than
definitely.
Minnesota has.
Oh, definitely, yes, yes.
Well, the really perfect example is to compare Wisconsin and Minnesota Point, where Duluth has really very little recreational facility on Minnesota Point because they've allowed it to be built up with homes, where Wisconsin Point is all state-owned, and there's just miles and miles of beaches for the people to use. But then again, the state suffers for that, in that that area is not taxable land. It's prime housing areas that they're not allowing to be built up.
There would be so many areas that we could work together in. Mm-hmm. One would be a mass transit, which is obvious. Another would be the medical field. But of course, then you have the physicians of each city at each other's throat because they can't practice in each other's states, mm-hmm. Most of them. A port authority, the Duluth Port Authority, which has a fantastic budget. And you compare that to the Superior port, which has almost nothing except to pay the salary of this lonely little fellow who really doesn't have much money to work with. If you could combine the best of both, or a tourism a bureau that would work not just for one city, but for both cities, there is an awful lot that these two cities could do together. And Superior, I think, especially suffers because they are small and don't have the resources available that, say, Duluth would. And by resources, I mean the tax money and the federal money available to a city the size of Duluth.
Well, there's all sorts of funny little problems, too, like going downtown and they won't cash an out-of-state check, or having to have a Wisconsin driver's license when we're probably doing most of our driving in Minnesota to work. And also my nursing license is not valid in Wisconsin, and you can't hold two licenses at the same time. And there's just little legal things like that that are great irritants when, you know, you're driving 5 miles across the bridge and you're all of a sudden out of state as far as suspect. It's very strange sometimes to come across those things.
On the western border of Minnesota, where Fargo on one side of the Red River is a North Dakota community, and Moorhead on the other side is part of Minnesota, the situation is not dissimilar. Dr. Albert Anderson is provost of Tri-College University, which brings together Concordia College, Moorhead State College, and North Dakota State University in an educational effort at breaking down some of the problems of existing boundaries. Does it really matter on which side of the river a person makes his home? Dr. Anderson believes it certainly did at one time.
Historically speaking, the one city, namely Fargo, became a good deal more, or became associated with commerce, with the place of the railroad, whereas the other city was, as Moorhead, a tent city, one associated with thieves, brigands, gamblers, houses of ill repute, saloons, and the like. So I suppose one could make a case for the fact that, historically speaking, the differences between the cities are deep-rooted. From that also stems, I think, the kind of perceptions or attitudes which you find that, in fact, differ between people. Moorhead has tried unusually hard to overcome its image as the suburb of Fargo. Fargo has the industry for the most part, or at least that's the way in which people come to describe Fargo. It has the principal shopping areas. It has the all-American city. It is certainly far more oriented to the agriculture of North Dakota and the valley than is Moorhead. Moorhead, it's true, has a relatively quiet residential character, but whenever there is talk of progress and development in Moorhead, it is most usually in conjunction with the concern or the desire to bring in industry or to develop the downtown business area, or again, do whatever is necessary to put it on all fours with its neighbor across the river.
One woman said, frankly, she said, I'd rather decorate our own living room before decorating somebody else's.
Sherry Herbst, quoting a friend who was speaking not of decorating living rooms, but of the loyalty she felt for her own community and its interests. As for Mrs. Herbst herself, she's been active in the formation of an arts council in Fargo-Moorhead that spans the river in terms of cooperation among individuals and groups, and has brought about some financial cooperation as well, but not quite enough.
I guess that I'd have to say that probably one thing would be in support of, financial support of organizations that don't exist in your own community. For instance, the Art Center exists in Moorhead. It does not exist in Fargo. And the community theater is located in Fargo, not in Moorhead. And we've laughed and said many times we think we should reroute the Red River and then we wouldn't have any problem at all. And probably this would be true. This river just becomes a real barrier. The community theater is barely across the river. I mean, it's just a half a block from the river, you know, but it doesn't get support from Moorhead to speak of it. Very minimal amount of even memberships. And it's just a very isolated group of people who even belong to it. I think the Red River Art Center, on the other hand, is very heavily supported by Fargo people. So it's a very interesting thing, I think, that it goes to one point, and that is that Moorhead people have a tremendous loyalty to their community. One problem, perhaps, that the Borders has, particularly in the arts, is in grants, government funding, and state funding to the arts. It's it does present a problem. And I think each state, of course, receives the same amount of monies from the federal government through the National Endowment. But then the legislatures have to appropriate their own funds in the state. North Dakota, for instance, appropriates $10,000 biannually. And Minnesota is up to about $300,000+. There's quite a difference. We keep thinking that because we are a part of Minnesota, more or less, even though the river happens to be there, the Fargo-Moorhead Community Theater still exists, the Fargo-Moorhead Symphony and the FM Civic Opera, that we should be receiving funding, for instance, from Minnesota. And Minnesota feels, yes, they would like to support everybody a little bit, but North Dakota, they figure, gets the same amount of money from the National Endowment and has many less things with which to do with their money. So it does present a problem there. They would like to see us get, for instance, the Red River Arts Center, they think should be receiving more funding from the North Dakota State Council on the Arts. And right now, the North Dakota State Arts Council is giving a considerable amount to the Red River Arts Center. Whether or not they would want to increase it, I certainly couldn't speak for them. But I think that they feel that they should be supported by the Minnesota State Arts Council.
There are, again, a great many people, and I am one of them, in the Fargo-Moorhead area committed to the notion of a single metropolitan area, to a center for the region, to the desirability of cooperation and coordination of services, to the development of resources and interests which lie very close at hand. We have what I regard as a far greater consciousness of planning, the planning of the city of the future in this area than I have seen before. And that will of necessity make of, say, the city of Moorhead, the future city of Moorhead, different from the city of Fargo. That is to say, while Fargo may have developed in a willy-nilly fashion in advance of the kinds of city planning that we have seen in recent years, it's possible for a city that is separated from it by a river and so subject to its own kind of development to control that development.
Dr. Anderson's points about encouraging the idea of a metropolitan center and the benefits of planning are good ones, but border communities and the states which control them often render little more than rhetoric regarding real authority for metropolitan councils. Dick Sihosky, director of the Head of the Lakes Council of Governments in Duluth, believes that's because agencies that do things are more popular and easier to comprehend than those whose people simply sit around and think.
I guess it's a phenomenon of Minnesota and the Duluth, city of Duluth, in that the city of Duluth is the most powerful, the most progressive government in this metropolitan area. It has the ability to cause the Minnesota legislature to enact special laws for it for special purposes. And it's done so on four or five occasions so far in creating authorities such as the Duluth Transit Authority, the Duluth Port Authority, the Duluth Airport Authority, the Spirit Mountain Authority, and perhaps some other similar types of functions that I can't think of now, that are area-wide, really area-wide metropolitan functions that cause a service, create a service that serves not only the Minnesota side of the area, but the Superior side. There is only one international airport. There is only one really functioning port authority. There is only one transit authority, and there is only one regional recreational ski authority or function. That's a Duluth agency. As a practical matter, those agencies are semi-independent, but the Duluth City Council, in fact, has budget powers over each one of them. So if one were to say who is in control of these area-wide regional interstate functions, one would have to say that the Duluth City Council is. So that as a practical matter, we have a de facto regional government in the City Council of Duluth.
John Sweeney is manager of the Duluth Transit System. Harvey Benson, president of the Transit Authority, which governs the operation of the buses. Ever since the City of Duluth took over the system, there's been difficulty in providing and getting paid for service to the Wisconsin City of Superior.
In Wisconsin, when we've changed the fares or changed the service, the Wisconsin Public Service Commission has said that we could not do so in Superior. We are owned by the City of Duluth, and the Minnesota State Legislature enacted the Duluth Transit Authority into being. And it was our legal counsel's opinion that we did not come under the jurisdiction of another public body in a different town or even a different state.
So what it all goes back to then is the fact that we're working with two state governments.
That's correct.
Beyond the
right.
two it's local governments.
I think the two cities could probably be easier resolved if they were both within the same state. But when you throw a state boundary up, then it becomes real critical.
There is a there's another aspect to that. The state of Wisconsin is very active in planning and providing input to their communities in mass transit. The state of Minnesota, as a state, is not. The state of Wisconsin has a Department of Transportation which addresses itself to this. The state of Minnesota does not, and it even failed in the last legislative session. So on the one hand, you have a state telling its people what's good for it in the way of transportation, and you have another state that ignores the whole problem.
So we're paying a lot of lip service to the idea of mass transit in Minnesota, but we aren't really coming through with bucks.
And we're doing this in the face of a federal conference that was held in Duluth in June of last year, right after the emergency situation caused by floods, in which the federal people from the Department of Transportation told the joint attendees from Wisconsin and Duluth that the federal government was going to look with some disdain upon neighboring communities that did not treat themselves as one common region. And they were going to look with favor upon those communities who would think regionalization. But that still hasn't come to pass.
Tom Burke is director of the Port of Duluth, another agency administered by a specially legislated authority. He sees the solution to the problem of mass transportation for the Duluth Superior area in the creation of a bi-state super-agency.
I certainly think that anybody involved in the transportation industry just sees a tremendous Frankenstein growing out of our all wanting to be king of the castle. You just can't work in the future. There's no place for kingmakers. And there is no place for people who won't move with the flow of progress, and as Governor Rockefeller says, get in the mainstream. There's certainly a cost saving to be realized if you would lump all of the transportation entities under one roof, and as I mentioned before, the cost saving would really be for the taxpayer. And I personally would have no problem if I thought that there was somebody more qualified than myself, another agency that was doing better than we're doing, that could prove to me they could handle the situation and do a better job, It wouldn't bother me if I were to move in and become a number two man or a number three man if I thought it was really going to be in the best interest of the public.
And Dixie Husky puts in a couple of final thoughts for the planners.
I think it's important that there be, in addition to those types of special authorities, a special agency, just a general planning agency, which supervises their functions, reviews the types of plans they're making to make sure that any conflicts between them are resolved. In addition, I guess it would be better, since these functions are all serving the interstate metropolitan area, if they really had representation from the whole area, including Duluth and Superior areas, the two states, and in addition, that they had some sort of tax-generating capability in both areas as well. Because as long as you have a situation where a service is being performed for certain people who are not in turn paying for the service, there's always going to be a chance for disparities or cutting service for those people, that sort of thing. If I were to sit at some high level and redesign the whole system, I would probably design a system where the areas in all states which have metropolitan urban type problems would be identified probably by the commuting range of people who work in them. And those areas would be set up with planning and development agencies, and that all the areas in between those quote islands unquote of urbanization would be handled through central state planning. The reason I do this is that I can see that the entire state in its rural and small town portions probably has more in common than do the areas that are now grouped within a single multi-county agency. There's very little relationship between Duluth Superior and Iron River, Wisconsin, for example. The problems Iron River has are not really the same types of problems we have here, yet we're grouped together with them in the multi-county regions. That's really why our metropolitan agency exists. We had to have a forum for the types of metropolitan problems that do exist and that have to be resolved. And they would just get lost in a regional multi-county framework.
Perhaps cooperation across boundaries can be expected to have a better chance when the efforts are made by organizations less enmeshed in the woof and warp of government. Like Dr. Anderson of Tri-College University in Fargo-Moorhead, Father F.X. Shea of Scholastica College in Duluth has become involved in a consortium of colleges which is now working to develop cooperative programs.
It's interesting that when we first started the conversations that led to the Lake Superior Association of Colleges and Universities, which is an awful name, but it's the one we came up with and we'll have to live with it. When we first started talking this way, all the institutional heads of the six institutions, three private, three public, two different states and two different countries, all of the heads have been, you know, gung-ho for the collaboration, because as responsible for the whole institution, we had to recognize that the sources of support would not enable us to continue on the multiversity, Stanford, Berkeley, Harvard model. Nevertheless, if all of us, and all of us in one measure or another, are peripheral to the mainstream, and the state institutions are very good institutions, but they're not the major campus of either of any of the systems. Lakehead, for example, is 800 miles from Toronto. That leaves you pretty isolated and pretty weak. So that all of us, in one way or another, recognize that in order to join the mainstream, we had to have a certain bulk and weight which we could not supply individually. So the pressures which trace back to the lack or the economic support, or the receding of economic support at least, these pressures for survival, growth, at least in reputation and regard, which in turn would bring in students and in turn bring in dollar support, all of these did compel us to drop the isolation and competitive model and to follow the collaboration model. I don't think that the association has been in existence long enough to, there are certain programs of collaboration that have, have a longer history than others. The collaboration between ourselves and UMD, now it's been extended into a kind of triangular trade with Superior, is something like 4 or 5 years old. Most of the other collaborative programs are gleams in the presidential eyes rather than actualities at the moment.
There's a paradox in all this, of course. And it's that at the same time we're looking critically at the usefulness of lines on a map or in one's mind that divide people of common interest, we're also, as a society and as individuals, taking a more positive view of the value of our differences. Father Shea put it this way.
One of the real problems with what we started out with, modernity, you know, the sense that no boundaries are worth anything. They're all crossable, and they should be. If you don't take certain boundaries, granted they may be boundaries you establish for yourself, and you may eventually cross them, but if you don't take them at least temporarily seriously, something happens to your own capacity to grow.
Interviews in the Fargo-Moorhead area were conducted by Bill Seemring and Marcia Elvar of KCCM. Musical selections from Aaron Copland conducts Music for a Great City, a CBS Masterworks recording. John Williams, more virtuoso music for guitar on Columbia. And the virtuoso recorder, From Folk Dances to Blues, by Bernard Cranis on the Odyssey label. A Sense of Place was written and produced by Claudia Daly for Minnesota Educational Radio under a grant from the Minnesota Humanities Commission. Engineering by Glenn Owen.